You're listening to the podcast, So You Want to Be a Writer, with Valerie Koo and Allison Tate. Valerie is an author, journalist, and national director of the Australian Writers' Centre, which is one of the world's leading providers of online and classroom courses for people who want to get published and write with confidence.
Allison Tate is a freelance writer, blogger, and author of the best-selling series The Mapmaker Chronicles. She has more than 20 years professional writing experience.
Each week they explore the world of writing, publishing and blogging to bring you news and opportunities, advice on how to succeed in the world of writing, interviews with top writers and much more. With students enrolling from all over the world, you can find out more about the Australian Writers' Centre at writerscentre.com.au.
Everyone, and welcome to episode 68 of So You Want to Be a Writer. My name's Valerie Koo, and I'm here with Allison Tate. How are you, Al?
I am lacking in patience today, Valerie, but that's okay. I call this just a symptom of the school holidays.
Oh, yes.
And it will be fine. It's a passing moment. But let's just say that my morning walk with Procrastic Pup was not very restful this morning because I had two other puppies with me.
Hangers on.
I know. I've got this. So Mr. 8 is this highly energetic child who, you know, bounces off all walls and he likes to run. And so we'll be walking along and he'll suddenly decide that he needs to run to the end of the block, which is awesome, you know, because he needs to do that. But as soon as he takes off, so does Procrasty Pup. And so he doesn't seem to realize that he's somewhat anchored.
Attached.
By me. I can't move as fast as either of them. And so we end up with this situation where I nearly lose my arm every time he takes off. So, yeah, so I'm pretty, put this way, I'm happy to be home and
you know,
sitting quietly at this point. And you, what are you up to?
What am I up to? I am taking my furry child, Rex the cat, to have an MRI, actually.
Oh, my.
Oh, my, yeah. So,
an MRI. Oh,
yeah,
my.
Yeah, a couple of issues there. So the MRI will show what's will apparently reveal if there's anything wrong, and hopefully there isn't anything wrong. But that comes at the lovely price of $2,500. So, gulp.
That's the Megatroid.
Yes, gulp. So instead of talking about such things.
Yeah, wow. Let's move on.
Move on to the world of writing and publishing and blogging this week. So I have a couple of links for you, which I think that you will like. Well, certainly the first one. It's so cute. It is this these cute little – now, do you use bookmarks? When you read books, are you a dog ear person
or
are you a bookmark person?
I am a dog ear person. I know. I am a bad, bad girl, but that's
okay.
What I do. Yeah,
I too am a dog ear person, I must admit, because, you know, it's just convenient. But I have something that might change your mind, and it's featured on a blog called Creative Boom, Inspiration and Ideas for Creatives. And what it is they're sticky markers. So they're like tiny little post-it notes. You know how you can get those tiny post-it notes where you can stick it on documents to say, sign here? They're all quite little. They're little post-it notes that, but they're not boring and they're not just colors. They're in different shapes. So there's like, you can build a landscape. So what happens is you get to a certain part in your book and you want to mark it and you can put a tree there, but then you get to another section and then you can put a different shaped tree, and you get to another section and you can put a square tree or a round tree or a hedge, or in some cases you can get cities. So you can build different different landscapes with different skyscrapers. Or there's also one of the Mars landscape, so you can have little aliens, little Martians with little big rocks and, you know, spaceships and stuff like that. And basically the point is every time you get to a point in your book where you need to mark it, you put one of these stickies, but by the end of the book you've built an entire landscape,
which is awesome. But you know what, I see a completely different use for these.
Oh.
Because when I edit, I use post-it notes to mark the page where something's, or where I've made a change and I need to make a change, or I use it to make a little note saying additional info here. So for me, I would use these to edit a manuscript and it would make the entire process way more beautiful. But I think that I would need not just a forest and a city and an alien landscape. I would need them all at once. So I would have an amazing mixture of different things, because I use so many of them. But yeah, I'm really attracted to these for that purpose, because I think it would kind of just make your whole manuscript look
Yeah, cool.
Nicer.
Because there's not just a forest and a city in an alien landscape. There's also the skyscape of Hong Kong and New York and London and the desert and Tokyo. So you there's see? A whole heap.
That I could put a whole world at the top of my manuscript because that's exactly. pretty much how many I use.
So we'll put the link in the show notes for those of you who are interested in getting that. Mm. But moving on to something very different, I came across a really interesting post this week from The Media Briefing, and it's about why journalists should care more about media business models. Now, it's quite a long post, but it's a really interesting discussion on the fact that so many journalists, because they've been brought up in a traditional, conventional journalistic environment, where there's such a divide between church and state, as in between editorial and advertising, they are so immersed in, you know, the integrity of the editorial and what's happening in their own editorial world, which of course is important, that they do not care or even listen to the advertising department or, quite frankly, who pays their salaries and who keeps the newspaper or magazine or whatever in existence. But increasingly, that's being merged, as we know, but also it's getting to the stage where some journalists are needing to write the, you know, advertorial content, or there's certainly the emergence of native advertising where the advertorial is embedded within the editorial, and, you know, some places do this more than others. But I think it poses a really interesting question of whether you should care where your salary comes from, because some journalists don't. They don't care about the business model at all. They just want to do their job and they want to do it well, which is great, but they don't want to see the big picture because they don't think it's their job. What are your thoughts on this?
Interesting. Well, I understand the perspective of journalists who don't want to know the business model because, as far as they're concerned, editorial is editorial and advertising should have nothing to do with it. Mm. However, the digital media landscape is very different. And, you know, I think the most interesting thing about it is that people are trying so many different business models, trying to make it work, trying to find some way to actually generate enough revenue from the internet to pay writers. And I mean, this is the other reason why all writers should care about this stuff, because as we've discussed before, everyone wants to get paid to write and nobody wants to pay to read. Mm. So, you know, if no one's paying to read, where's the money coming from, you know, so that you get paid to write? Yep. So I think it's absolutely essential that that journalists, not only journalists who are on staff, but also freelance writers, have a very strong understanding of the different business models and how they work and what their role is in each particular one. Because, you know, as they point out, like, if they're running banner ads on a website, then, you know, it's all down to clicks. It all comes down to how many eyeballs hit that page. So as a writer, you're judged from, you know, by the editorial team, by the people who are paying your salary, so to speak, by how many people you can bring to that website and how many people your story brings. So in those sorts of instances, sometimes it comes down to you actually selling off your social media presence as well as your words. Mm. So, you know, I think it's absolutely essential that people understand how this stuff works, just so they know what their role is and how much of that they actually want to get involved in.
Yeah, absolutely. And also in career planning, because then you can, if you can see the bigger picture and the bigger landscape, you can see where you might fit in down the track or where your career might go.
Mm, very true.
But what have you got for us this week?
Oh, well, I've got competitions. Yay.
Oh,
it's a day for competitions. So the first competition I have is the Ruth Rendell short story competition is now open for entries. So it was launched on the 22nd of June. It's the fifth Ruth Rendell short story comp, and it's the challenge is for writers to write a piece in any genre in no more than 1,000 words. Any genre, a short story, 1,000 words, it's not much. And the winner of the competition will receive £1,000 because it's a UK-based comp, and will be commissioned to write four further stories for Interact over the course of 1 year. So it's kind of a great opportunity to get your work out there, make a bit of money. The closing date for submissions is Thursday, the 29th of October, 2015. And the winner will be chosen by Linda LaPlante, who is, of course, you know, mega best-selling author.
Yeah.
So I just thought I'd flag that one with you, which is a great thing. And we'll put the link in the show notes to that.
And also, it's definitely open to non-UK people, everyone.
It is, so, yes. Yep. I double-checked that before I even brought it to anyone's attention. And the second one is a very timely one, given that we are still, as I well know, in the midst of the school holidays. Mm-hmm. But Random House Australia and Tristan Banks have launched a competition. It's called the My Life Short Story Competition. It's open to students in Australia who are aged 8 to 13. So this is very young. So if you're a mum out there with a kid or a dad with a kid who likes to write, you should totally flag this because it's awesome. It's a 500-word short story, and it's sharing a story. The child needs to share a story about their life that is funny, gross, weird, or amazing, obviously based on Tristan's My Life series. But the prizes are fantastic. So the winning story wins $1,000 cash.
Wow. Imagine being an 8-year-old getting
$1,000. I know. A signed set of the My Life series and also $1,000 worth of books for your school.
Oh, wow.
So it's a really, really great comp. So the closing date for that one, I just had it in my sights and
it's
now
the
I've 31st
lost it. Of August.
Thank you. Well done. Excellent. Mm. And the children need permission from a parent, teacher, or guardian to enter. So we'll put the link in the show notes to that one. But what a great initiative. I'm so excited by it. I'm trying to line my boys up to write. They're both looking at me like, okay, mum, whatever. Whatever. I'd rather run to the corner, but that's okay. Anyway, so that's where we're at.
Awesome. I think competitions are awesome. I think that they, you know, they give you such an opportunity to flex your writing muscle and give you something to aim for.
Because they give you a deadline.
A deadline, really. Mm. Because so often you might be working on your major, you know, novel and it sits in your drawer and it can take, you know, years sometimes for you to get the confidence and the time and all of that. But little competitions like this for short stories are just short and sharp and they, you know, you can achieve 1500 words or 3000 words or whatever it is that they're looking for in a short space of time. And it just flexes that writing muscle.
Do you know the other thing I think is really valuable about competitions? And I know this because I entered a few through the Romance Writers of Australia runs regular competitions for authors. And I entered a few back, you know, when I was first starting out. And the interesting thing about a competition like that one, those ones, is that they give you feedback. They send you feedback. Right. And so I entered two competitions and one of them was a first kiss competition and one of them was an opening chapter or some, or, you know, something like that. So in both cases, I got three lots of feedback from three different judges. Mm. And in both cases, one of them loved it. These are two different, you know, obviously all different judges. Yep. One of them loved it. One of them hated it with a passion, like just didn't like anything about my voice. And one of them was, you know, somewhere in between. And so I think what it teaches you to enter things like that and to get feedback like that, it shows you how subjective writing is. And it shows you that not everyone is going to love your work. Not everyone is going to hate your work and that sometimes rejection is based not necessarily on what you've done but on who's read your work. So it's kind of it's a really good way. I mean, it's a great way to start learning all about rejection. Not that I'm suggesting that this will happen with the kids' stories.
No.
But for adult authors, it's a great way to start really getting your head around the subjectivity of publishing and how important it is to persist, because what you want to find is that one judge or that one person, that one agent, that one publisher who loves your work.
Yes.
And sometimes that takes a few goes.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, also on this competition that Tristan Banks and Random House are doing, it's for kids aged 8 to 13. I think it's great to encourage that age group, well, any age group, of course, but let's say that particularly that age group, to write. Now, you've got children that age. What do you do to encourage them to write? Because it's different to reading.
To be honest with you, they write a lot. You know what they love? And this is something I know a lot of parents say to me, I can't believe you let, you know, that you of all people encourage your boys to read comics. I'm like, are you kidding me? Mm. I love comics.
I love comics too.
And comics are fantastic for kids who, you know, because they're a quick read, but that relationship between the graphic and the words is so interesting. And so my boys draw comics, a lot of comics. They make up their own, they create their own characters, they have, you know, they put the little dialogue things in and the little square boxes and then ... so they do a lot of that sort of stuff. I just say to them, like, if we, for example, I was out the back yesterday doing my version of gardening, which at the moment is like slash and burn. I'm pruning everything in the garden,
okay,
which took me about 4 hours. Oh. And so they were out there with me for a while, and then they got annoying. And I was like, why don't you go inside and read a book or write a story or draw a comic or make a movie or do something useful? So they did. They went off and they started working on a comic series together. And then they put on a concert last night for us as well,
because
they decided they'd do a little duet. So I think it's about just putting – sometimes it's as matter as simple as putting the idea in their heads.
Yes.
Why don't you go and write a story?
Yeah, right.
Why
what comics,
don't you?
What comics did you read? Did you read?
As a kid.
Well, whatever. Do you still read comics?
No, I don't read them so much anymore. As a kid, I loved the Archie comics.
Oh, yeah, loved Archie comics.
We used to also like Richie Rich, sisters and I. And we used to love the Beagle Boys. I don't know if you remember them, but they were like
a spin-off.
Yeah, Uncle Scrooge and the Beagle Boys.
Right.
They kept trying to steal his money. It was awesome. Yeah, we loved those. And
I loved Asterix.
Oh, yeah, the boys love Asterix.
Yes.
We have quite a few of those.
I think
those.
I've read every Asterix Tantam.
Yeah, no, they're fantastic. Mm. My boys are really into Marvel, you know, superheroes.
Yes. I watch them on TV now.
Batman. We have a lot of Batman going on around here.
Yes.
Those kinds of things. So they really like it. And the Green Lantern.
Oh,
like,
yes.
I didn't even know there were 10 Green Lanterns, but there are. And, yes, you can get them in all shapes and sizes, and they all have a different ring. Yes, of course they do. I just think, you know, if there's something that makes a child read, that absorbs them and takes them away to a different world, then I would never discourage it, ever.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I must admit, I don't read Batman and the Green Lantern and, you know, Flash and all that these days. I watch them on television instead.
Yeah.
But speaking of television, what shows – there's a point to this question, Alison.
Okay, I'm waiting.
What shows are you watching at the moment?
Now, we talk about this quite a lot because I'm actually not a major TV watcher, because I just, you know, generally speaking, TV time is probably when I'm trying to get my writing done, because
yes,
I don't have a lot of time. But I do love a good series. So I'm currently watching Wolf Hall on DVD, because as everybody knows, I'm still ploughing through it. So I'm kind of hoping that it might encourage me to actually get to the end.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, you know, I loved The Wire. My husband and I watch a lot of that sort of Scandinavian, you know, we watch a lot of SBS.
All right.
Borgen and The Bridge, and I love anything with a bit of a subtitle and some kind of dark thing. Yep, love that.
You love anything with a subtitle.
I do. I love a good subtitle. So we watch – yeah, it's really funny though. I watch them and by the end of them I'm pretty convinced I'm actually understanding Danish.
Oh, my God.
And I turn the subtitles off, I realise that I'm really not understanding Danish.
Well, the point of that question.
What is the point of that question? What do you like to watch? Tell me that before we go further.
All right. Well, everyone, you know, regular listeners will know that recently I've been watching Arrow because, you know, it's a really – it's just a pure escapism and it's good fun, which is one of those superhero movies. But, you know, I love House of Cards. I love Orange is the New Black. I'm actually about to get into Halt and Catch Fire. I'm not sure whether I'll get into it yet, but we'll see. I'm only up to episode 2. But the reason I bring this up is because of our writer in residence this week.
Oh.
Yes, because our writer in residence is screenwriter. So he's written feature films and also television shows. And he's written from everything from Rafferty's Rules to Water Rats to Stingers to All Saints, Heartbreak High. He started off with comedy with the Auntie Jack Show and the Norman Gunston Show, that sort of thing.
Okay.
He's also written plays, and he created – I don't know if you grew up with this. I grew up with this. I used to rush home from school and watch Sweet and Sour.
Oh, loved it.
Yes, loved it.
I loved it. Some of those songs.
I know.
If I don't do that.
And he's currently writing a bunch of co-productions with Germany, where there's two lead characters who are Australian, two lead characters who are German, because of the trend of co-productions these days. And he's –
will there be subtitles?
I don't know. That's a very good question.
Be exciting.
Yes. Hmm. But he's also the teacher of screenwriting at the Australian Writers' Centre. And so let's have a chat to a wonderful font of information about the world of screenwriting. It's absolutely fascinating. Let's talk to Tim Gooding. So thanks for joining us today, Tim.
Thank you, Valerie.
Now, let's start off with, how did you get into screenwriting?
I half fell into it. I started off writing for, well, I actually started off writing for stage. I grew up in the country and used to listen to radio a lot and started writing little radio plays, which I'd record with my cousins on a tape recorder.
Wow.
When I got to university, that sort of morphed into writing for university reviews and things like that. Mm. After leaving university, I started writing for the stage, and then just was in the right place at the right time, heard about an opening, and plugged in, started writing screen sketch comedy.
Right.
For the Auntie Jack show, that was quite a while back,
yep.
But it was a good time to be around. And so I started writing for the small screen, and then gradually, you know, moved up into the larger formats.
Yeah. So you started off writing comedy, which makes sense because you were doing things like the university reviews and stuff.
That's right.
Like that. But then you moved also into drama. I know you've written for Rafferty's Rules and Blue Heelers and Stingers and Water Rats, All Saints, and of course my favourite, Heartbreak High.
Yeah.
One of my favourites. So what was that like when you did, how did you discover your craft? You know, how did you learn about your craft?
Well, I learned about it on the job, basically. There weren't schools around in those days, so you did actually learn on the job. It was a good time, and I started in the 70s, which is quite some time ago, but it was a good time to start because basically anything went to a certain extent. People didn't really, nobody really knew what they were doing or was certain they knew what they were doing, so that made them a bit more open. Mm. You can make more mistakes, and I certainly made them, but there was always someone around who'd say, no, that's not right, try this. And so, yeah, we learnt by doing, mm. with in consultation with people who knew better. Who were already in the industry. So that's how I branched out. And you know, I don't know how my first few purely dramatic scripts were. They sort of got made, but you know, they weren't Citizen Kane. I learned on the job and got better at it. And there was always someone to point out, and particularly in television, which is fairly rigorous in its time demands, there was always someone saying, no, that's not right. Do it like this. You weren't left on your own for a long time, because they had deadlines, very tight deadlines. And that if it wasn't working, they made it work. Mm. And if something you wrote wasn't working and it turned up on the screen, they'd fixed it. And you could see from what they'd done how they had fixed it. So yeah, that's how I learned. Still learning. I mean, there's no such thing as a perfect script.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it is a craft. Above all else, that's probably the first thing I tell my students: it's a craft, not a mystery. But you've got to learn it, and
yeah.
You learn it by doing it. You don't learn it in your head. You can understand it in your head, but until you actually do it over and over again, and the pennies start to drop, you don't improve. I'm not a carpenter, but I use the example to the class of, you know, I could imagine a chair, but it would look ugly and it would collapse when people sat on it because they haven't learned the craft.
Yeah.
Same with painting in most forms. So it's a craft that can lead to art. But you've got to learn the craft first, and the way you learn that is by doing it over and over again, and people telling you where you're going wrong.
Mm. So when you are writing for television, it's such a collaborative process. There's so many factors involved, you know, existing characters, how much time you might have with an actor, whether you can shoot outdoors, all that kind of stuff. Is that good or is that frustrating for you?
I don't find it frustrating. It can, if you do too much of it, it can, in a way, you know, taking too many shortcuts and being, you know, writing to a sort of template too often can sort of, you can lose your ability to write in other forms, if that makes sense. Because, I mean, when I write for an episode of something that's been running for, you know, a year or two, you just have to plug in and follow their format.
Yes.
But all television involves sort of shortcuts in dramatic writing, purely, if not because of the small screen, because of the budgets. So it's very different to writing, say, a feature. But you know, you use different techniques in writing features, and there's not so much the time and money constraints that there are in writing for television. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you get used to it. I mean, I get used to knowing that in an hour of television that you're only allowed 10 to 12 minutes of outside broadcast and the rest has to be done in the studio with sets. Mm. And you just write to that. The first one or two are a little bit difficult, but then you just, you know, it's part and parcel of the craft of TV writing. It's different to writing for radio or stage or film, but it's part and parcel of the craft.
Some people would find that surprising because they haven't thought about it, that, you know, you could, there's budgets that mean you can only do 10 to 12 minutes of outside shooting. What are some other kind of creative or budgetary limitations that some people might find surprising about the process?
Well, the budget thing is probably the most surprising because, you know, you can't have unlimited characters. Mm. If you write all these guest characters in as well as your... you know, long-standing characters.
Unless you're Game of Thrones.
unless you're Game of Thrones. And even then, you can notice with Game of Thrones, they can spend much more money by their fourth series than they can in their first.
Yes.
Because they've had a huge success. I noticed that also in Downton Abbey. Because it's such a huge success, they've got much more money to spend than they had in the first series, so they can afford to do luxurious shoots at other castles where not a lot happens, but it just looks good, which they certainly couldn't do in series one because of money constraints.
Yes.
But you know, when you have to write for your long running characters with TV, and if you want to bring in a guest, you know, there's usually limits on how many you can bring in for craft reasons as well as budget reasons. I mean, you're supposed to focus on your main story. I mean, I think that's probably one of the first things an inexperienced writer does is thinks of a story that involves another character rather than plugging straight into what the long-running character is doing, and that's generally not the way to go. Mm.
You mentioned that when you sometimes you can start writing for a series 2 years after it started.
Yes.
And when you do that, do you go back and watch every episode to make sure you get everything, or is it a bit time consuming?
Yeah, you're supposed to, I think. No. You're usually given a few DVDs to watch of past episodes. They also you're also provided what is called the Bible, which is generally a 30 or 40-page document with all the information about the standard characters, the standard storylines, the sets, those sorts of things, so that you bone up on what's gone before and what template you have to fit into before you go along and, you know, with your storyline, or go along to sit at a table and make up a storyline. There's also a person called a story editor who usually keeps an eye on continuity. So they will say, no, you're drifting off. You know, if you supply a story idea, and they might say, no, you're drifting away from what we're really about. So they keep an eye on the way things, you know, continue in sync, if you like.
Mm-hmm. And so when you don't join a TV series and you actually create one of your own, like you created Sweet and Sour from scratch, and that was your idea, and... for people of, you know, certainly my age, they'll remember Sweet and Sour, and it launched careers like Tracy Mann and David Rain and Archie Michael, but it also had so many iconic Australian musicians appearing in it at some point. Like, you know, I remember seeing Chrissy Amphlett, and there was Renee Geyer, John English, Red Simons, John Paul Young. It's such a huge part of growing up, if you were growing up at that time. Where did that idea of Sweet and Sour come from? Were you just sitting around one day and you thought, oh, this might be a good idea for a television series?
I think it developed over time, but I just had the idea that the idea of a story of a band that didn't make it would be good, because all the stories about bands previously have been about bands that went from rags to riches, and I would like to do one about most bands who don't make it. And then because I'd also been working in the music industry and playing in bands myself, I knew a lot of people, and I thought, well, it'd be great to just give them sort of an edge of, if not credibility, some sort of amusement of just having guest roles for people where you could play spot the pop star.
Yes.
So that became part of it. Also, the songs that were used, I wanted the music to be credible rather than average TV music. TV music can tend to be just, it's not real in the sort of pop sense, if you like. It's more just written for TV, and I wanted it to be more written by actual songwriters, so I sort of used my contacts to get 20 or so different songwriters to submit stuff to the musical director and sort of thereby make a sort of a credible music soundtrack. I mean, the idea was to try and, as far as possible in a 6:30 time slot, which does, you know, have severe restrictions, to try and get it as close to reality, if you like, as possible. It's not strictly possible, and it's not documentary, and at 6:30, you know, you obviously there are things you can't do.
Yes.
But for that audience, as far as possible, we try to, you know, keep it real, if you like, and especially not have it one of those, you know, glamour stories where from comes from nowhere and rockets to stardom. I didn't want that. I wanted just sort of, you know, and I wanted them to at the end to have a choice between friendship and music, or the band, if you like, and they chose friendship. That's basically it. So it grew as it went, and it got bigger, and we had a bit of a fight to get it all accepted because it was a little bit out of the usual mould of those series.
Yeah, it wasn't Famous Five.
No, it wasn't Famous Five, and it was not cheap either. I mean, it was more expensive to record our own music and all that. But you know, we argued and argued, and also at that time, I guess it was the early 80s. There was bigger budgets, if you like. It has got much tighter in TV now. It's just more governed by marketing and economics, whereas the ABC then still had a bit more money. It wasn't quite as glorious as the early 70s, but the ABC still had a bit of money to make stuff, and they took a chance and it worked.
So let's move on to writing screenplays for a movie. Can you tell us about the creative process? So, you know, do you start with the premise and then see where it unfolds? Because I talk to many novelists who don't actually know what's going to happen in this story. Or do you have to map it out because it's a screenplay is so structured? How does it work for you?
I don't like to map it out.
Oh.
And if I can possibly avoid mapping it out, I will. And I usually only map out stuff if there's a deadline. If someone else is involved and saying you have to deliver within 6 weeks, then I might map something out to short circuit the process. But no, I prefer just to start with a character and a trigger incident so that something happens to someone and I like to follow it where it goes.
Wow.
And if the incident is big enough, then it will generate enough material for a feature film, which is why feature films are all about big things like love, hate, redemption, revenge, all those big themes, because if something happens that involves that, it provides enough material to sustain, or can provide enough material to sustain for 90 or more minutes. But yeah, that's my favourite process is just to start with one character that I'm sort of know a bit about, but not a lot, and something happened to them, and then see what happens. I mean, you still have to make choices. You know, there are always options as to what they can do in certain circumstances, and your sort of challenge as a screenwriter is to choose the option that gives you the most interest, if you like, for an audience.
How often do you go down that path and it doesn't lead anywhere?
Well, that happens. And then you go back to the start. I mean, that also is the process. You know, most films take umpteen drafts to get right. And so if it doesn't lead to where you want to go, you go back and start again. But if you get to the end and you've got something, then you go back and rework the bits that don't work. And that's when I usually start structuring, if you like, after I've done a draft or more, rather than trying to think about the exact shape of it from the beginning. I like to just get a story up and then go back and rework and structure after the fact, if you like. But yeah, there's always the chance that you come up with something that doesn't work. I mean, that is the same for novelists and whoever else, I think, you know, you just follow your leads and then you go back and back and back and back and back until you come up with something.
Movies, though, because you've got 90 minutes or however long to tell the story, and there's so much you, in a sense, can't write about because unlike novels, you can't write all these pages and chapters of a backstory or the inner thoughts of a character or why they've got this disease or whatever. In a movie, you have to somehow visually explain everything. How do you get over that? Like, what sort of techniques or tricks do you have to make sure that happens effectively?
Well, the trick is only include crucial detail that an audience absolutely cannot do without and leave the rest to their imagination. Because what happens when people see a movie, their imagination fills in all the stuff that's left out. And you've sort of got to trust that, accept that. That's the hard thing for the inexperienced writer to get, is what you leave out is sometimes even more important than what you put in. You've got to choose just enough so the audience can follow the story, but let them supply any detail that isn't absolutely crucial to be spoken or depicted. And that's a technique that you develop with time and experience. I sort of give my students the example that 6 lines are always better than 16, let alone 60. And that's a hard one for them to grasp, but it's true because, you know, really each and every scene usually only makes one point, I mean, there are exceptions, of course, but there's one point, like she's leaving him or he's shooting him or he's injured in a car crash or whatever. That's the point of the scene. The rest is detail, and you don't need as much. The audience just needs the basic steps, and they fill it in, which is why old movies feel a bit slow, because in 40 or 50 years ago, they used to put in more steps, but now we're much more exposed to media, and we're more used to making the leaps, especially, you know, if you had this sort of media, TV and stuff from the age of two, then you're well-versed in, you know, putting stuff together, so you don't need all the baby steps.
Yes.
You only need the big links in the chain, and the rest can be left out.
So speaking of leaving out the detail then, I want to talk a bit about research. So sometimes you need a certain level of research for your movies, or let's even say like some of the dramas that I mentioned earlier, like Rafferty's Rules, which is about the law, Blue Heelers and Stingers and Water Rats about police, All Saints about doctors. Mm-hmm. So what kind of level of research do you typically get to when you're dealing with, industries, specific industries and professions like that?
Well, usually those series have researchers on tap. Mm. So if you've got a particular question, you can call up, an ex-policeman or an ex-nurse or someone like that, and they will give you the information you need. And quite often when you're plotting out a story, I mean, especially in police shows, it's always seemed to be there'd be an ex-cop sitting in at the table as you came up with a story. And they would say, no, that wouldn't happen, or this will happen, or whatever. So to a certain extent, with long-running TV series in this country anyway, you don't have to do your own research. I mean, there are always instances where you do, but with TV in particular, usually there's someone, if it is a specialty area, there's usually someone either with you when you're doing the storyline or someone you can contact when you have a question. Mm. So, that sort of speeds up the process as well. There are always instances where you can do, and the internet has sort of helped along those lines. But then even with the internet, you want to know what the information you're getting is actually accurate and specific to this country. So you usually do need to talk to someone who knows what they're talking about. Mm. But TV sort of makes it a bit easier. With regard to feature film, you usually have to do your own. I don't know how it works in other countries, but in Australia, if you're writing about some specialty subject, you have to do your own research. I mean, you have to know the old chestnut. You know what you're writing about, and so you have to do your research and try and immerse yourself. Find out about that world that you don't know about, and don't proceed until you do. Because audiences can smell it. You know, if you don't know what you're talking about, audiences just smell it.
Yeah, for sure. So apart from, you've been involved in quite a number of iconic Australian shows and movies, but I understand that more recently you've been doing some work with Germany as well. How does that come about? How do you broaden your international career like that?
Partly it just dropped into my lap, but that's the sort of name of the game to a certain extent now, because budgets are going up and the amount of money available in this country is going down. More and more productions are co-productions. In other words, you have to sell to other countries in order for a program to make its money back. So this show I worked on in Germany wasn't my idea, it was someone else's idea, but they had devised it as a sort of Australian-German co-production with two lead characters German and two lead characters Australian. So I basically went along for that. But now I've got one of my own that I'm trying to get up, which I hope is going to be an English-Australian co-production. So I am trying to devise it with that in mind. And I've been visiting, going to London three times in the last 8 months, trying to set up that end of the process, if you like.
So it's not just writing, it's actually putting together the different collaborators in order to make it happen.
More and more it's getting to that. If you want to get your own series up, it is much more and more down that road. You can't just sort of write your own series these days and Australia makes it. It doesn't happen very often. It happens much less than it used to anyway.
Sure.
It has to be sort of amenable, approachable to overseas markets, and you need to do your research if you want that. If it's really base level Aussie soap, maybe not so much, but even Aussie soap, has been huge overseas. But if anything that's going to require a lot of money, we can't afford to do it here, and you have to take that into account when you do it. And either you hook up with a producer who does it for you, or you do it yourself, and try and design it that way.
And what do you enjoy most about writing for television or writing for feature films? What's the bit that makes, you know, your eyes light up and makes you smile, kind of thing?
When they make it, they get paid. No. The most joyful time for me is when I'm exploring. When I'm just up in my shed where I write, and as I said, I've started off with a trigger incident and a character, and I'm just exploring. Wow. And I've got the liberty, the freedom to follow that story wherever I want, and I can just live in that world in my head. That's the most enjoyable thing for me. And I try and, you know, writing is an end in itself. It's not just a means to an end. You can fall into that trap with, particularly with television, where it just becomes a means to an end, you know, making a living. That you can fall into that trap and you lose the sight of why you wrote in the first place, which is, it's fun. It is actually fun. And in especially in a small country where, you know, it's not easy to make a living. You have to get the fun out of it. You have to get the nourishment from just the writing, because if you're just in it for a living, you get very stressed.
Yeah, right. So you love the ideas that
I love the idea and exploring where it can go.
Yeah. And so you also teach screenwriting, because you teach here at the Australian Writers Centre. What do you enjoy about teaching screenwriting?
What do I enjoy about I think I enjoy it most when I see a penny drop. And someone, suddenly a student gets it. You know, I mean, every now and again I get a student who's got it already, but most come in and they don't have much experience with the screenwriting, and so they can, as I said before, they can understand it academically, but when they come to actually write, they can't actually put those principles into practice. But when someone, you know, like I say, well, try this, da-da-da, they go away and they come back and it seems like the penny's dropped, they've got it, you know, they've got... For example, the oldest principle in screenwriting, especially for the big screen, is show, don't tell. Now, show the audience and let the audience deduce. Don't tell us what's happening in the dialogue. You know? But most students go away and they start to write a scene, they write three pages of dialogue because we live in a word culture. So they start writing, the characters start saying, I'm feeling sad. No, just show us the picture of them crying, you know, or something like that.
Yep.
But when that penny drops, when they stop writing words coming out of people's mouths, and they've found it, you know, like almost written a silent scene where the audience has seen that scene and then the audience knows exactly what it's about without having any dialogue or without being told exactly what's going on. That's probably the best moment for me when one of those, there's about half a dozen pennies, I suppose, when one of those pennies drops. You know, also, you know, like leaving out stuff. When a student suddenly says, oh, yeah, I can cross out every third line and it doesn't make any difference, it actually makes it better. That sort of thing, that's when it sort of is most rewarding, if you like.
And what sort of advice would you give to people who are aspiring screenwriters, apart from obviously doing a course like yours? What else can they do? Like, what else should they be feeding their mind with or exploring themselves?
I think they should look at scripts. Go online and Google free feature films or free short film scripts, and then read those scripts and get a bit of a handle on what they actually look like. I mean, screenwriting is a very curious format of writing. In a way, it's like cartooning. It's not so much writing in a literary fashion. Familiarise themselves with screenplays. Maybe sit and watch a film with the screenplay in front of them. And if they want to write, start writing. Just write anything. Just get stuff down on paper that they can then look at and decide, well, if I was an audience, would this work for me? The sooner they start the process of actually writing rather than thinking I have to learn all this stuff before I can start writing, I think it's better just to start. I mean, yes, within the format, but if they have a look at some screenplays, you can pretty much pick that up, you know, in 10 or 15 minutes, and then write something. Write something and get to the end.
You mentioned short films.
Yes.
How useful or important is that in a screenwriter's development? Should they be starting with short films?
In my opinion, yes. Writing a feature film from scratch is a big, big project, and you tend to get lost in the story rather than learning the craft. You tend to get lost in what can happen in my story rather than learning the craft of of screenwriting, which is also why we started the Writers' Centre with a short film script. Short films are also important in other ways. If you get together with a few like-minded souls and make a little short film, and then get it into Tropfest or Short and Sweet or the St Kilda Film Festival or any of those film festivals, and a producer sees it, that's the only time the industry will come to you. That's the only time a producer or their representative will come to you and say, oh, I liked what you did. Have you got anything more? That's when you pull out your feature film idea or your feature film script.
Right.
It's a way of getting into the industry. Because the industry, there's no career path. You know, when students graduate, they don't automatically, there aren't headhunters out there looking at them to get them jobs. You've got to get your toe in the water, your foot in the door, or whatever the metaphor is. Mm. And one of those ways to do that and have a good time and learn is to make a short film. I'm all for it. I think short film making is a very undervalued form in itself. I think it's a very great shame that we don't show short films, for example, on television very much.
Yeah.
Because you can tell a big story in a short film if you like, but they tend just to be in festivals, and that's all. Which, they serve a purpose, but they are things in themselves as well.
Yeah, similar to the short story, is very undervalued as well.
Yes.
Finally, tell us about when you're in writing mode, you're writing a series or you're in, film, whatever, and you're in your shed. tell us about do you have a routine? Do you have you wake up at this time, you do this for the first half of the day. What's your writing routine?
Yes, my writing routine is I'm not an early starter. So I probably don't start. I mean, I'll get up, have a cup of coffee, have breakfast, but I probably won't start till 9:30. I will write straight through till 2:30 or 3 o'clock, and not eat lunch. I found that if I eat lunch, I get fatigued and sort of you need to start again. So I try and get 5 or so good hours in before I take a break. I'm very good at just plunking my bum on the seat at that time.
Right.
The also 9 to 3 thing also happened to coincide when I was up. My son has left home now, but it used to coincide with his school hours as well. Uh-huh. Where I'd sort of sort him out before 9 o'clock and get him off, and then he'd be home at 3:30. That was also governed by that.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, different writers have different routines, but mine is get up, have a bit of breakfast, go straight for 5 or 6 hours, then have lunch, relax a bit, then go back and look at what I've done. Usually print it out and look at it in hard copy form, and in a slightly different context, where looking at it on paper is different to looking at it on screen for some reason.
Yeah.
And so I sort of, I tend to go over what I've done for that day. So that's my routine. It's always been pretty much the same. When I was younger, I used to write in long spurts, but these days I'm much more sort of, routine-oriented and glad of it. But it's a habit. And like most things, once you get the habit and you just stick to it.
It's a discipline, isn't it? You have to put your bum in that seat and not just hope that inspiration's going to hit you like a bolt of lightning.
Well, you can't think about inspiration. You just do it. It's like going swimming in winter. If you think about it, you won't do it. you just got to go and jump in. I find it's, even if my mind's telling me, you don't want to do it today, you're not feeling like it, da da da. As soon as I turn on that screen and it lights up, I start. So all those doubts go away. So you've just got to get yourself to that point and you're okay.
Yep.
It's a habit, but you've got to have it. You can't just write one thing. And inspiration, I find that. Inspiration, perspiration, the balance is pretty much the same. I've written horrible stuff when I'm inspired and I've written really good stuff when I haven't been inspired and vice versa. So, on the average, it evens itself out.
Love it. And on that note, thank you so much for your time today, Tim.
Thank you very much, Valerie. Good to talk.
Okay, so there you go.
Well, that was just fascinating.
I thought it was worthwhile to chat to Tim because, that, you know, we talk so much about different genres of writing, then we sometimes forget that there are so many limitations and parameters involved in screenwriting, you know, like even with a television show that you can only do 10 to 12 minutes of scenes outside because otherwise they don't have the money, the budget to film it, you know, those sort of little things. So it's fascinating insight into the world of screenwriting from someone who's been doing it for ages.
Yep, fantastic.
So I have a web pick for the week. Now, this is more useful for people who write, you know, business writing, who write things like documents at work and stuff like that. You can certainly use it for fiction and otherwise, but it's far more useful for, you know, business writing. And you know how that there are lots of different readability sort of scores, like the Gunning-Fogg Index and the Flesch-Kincaid Index. And for those of you who don't know what that is, the Gunning-Fogg Index measures readability. So the index estimates like what year at school you've written the text in. So, for example, a Fogg index of 12 means that you've written, you need a reading level of a high school senior, like if in the US, so around 18 years old, you know. So depending on, so some newspapers make sure that they only have a Gunning-Fogg index of around 8 or thereabouts. Mm. Some go higher, like academic work is probably a little bit higher. But there's a site called readability-score.com. And what you do is you cut and paste your text into the box that they've got there, and it will calculate calculate the Gunning-Fogg score for you, the Flesch-Kincaid score for you. It'll calculate how many sentences you have in there, how many words per sentence, because sometimes people put too many words in a sentence, how many syllables. So it's just people who are into numbers and who want to make sure that their business documents are readable may find this particular website useful.
Yeah, fantastic.
There you go.
You're always up there with the interesting bits about numbers of syllables.
But I have a good question for you.
Okay.
For our working writer's tip, because this came up in our graduate groups. How long until you – now, this is an interesting question, so I'm interested to know what your answer is. How long until you follow up with an editor on an article that's been commissioned? So they've commissioned you. You know, they go, yeah, I want this article, and you've sent it in. What happens next? Do you follow up? How long do you follow up?
Interesting. I've never had an experience where they haven't come back to me. I think I would double, like if I didn't hear back from them, at least got it, thanks very much, I would probably follow up the next day to say, did you receive it? Has it gone to your spam folder?
But what if that they did say, got it, and that's it?
Well, then they got it.
Exactly.
I'd send my invoice.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Because there are some new writers who are wanting feedback.
Oh.
And, you know, editors don't have time to give you feedback, nor do they have time to tell you exactly what date they're going to publish it, because they're too busy juggling things, and sometimes they only decide on publishing something at the last minute. So they're not going to go back to every single writer, are they? And tell them.
Well, I just think it's here because it means they like it and there's no questions and you've done a good job and beautiful. Send your invoice, off you go.
Yeah, but you know, if you do happen to hear back 3 weeks later with some questions, well, that's fine, just answer the questions.
Yeah, that's right. You just go, okay,
So yes, I do agree. If you haven't heard that they've actually received it, I would check that they've received it, but I would not be bugging them for feedback or any other, you know, or hurrying them along in any other way.
No.
What if somebody does that, what do you think the editor would think of them?
Oh, I think they would think that they were probably fairly amateur, and I think that they would get annoyed because at the end of the day, like they will get back to you if they need to. They will come back to you if they have questions. They will come back to you. Otherwise, it's like, great, you've done a good job. We're sending it through to subs and off you go.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that would be my probable initial thought.
Yeah, definitely. So we're almost at the end of our podcast, but I want to tell listeners about something that you're working on, Al.
Oh, okay, excellent. What are you telling them about?
You're working on a new course.
I am.
Yes. called Build Your Author Platform, How to Boost Your Brand and Grow Your Fan Base.
That's right. I am
yes,
doing that.
Very
Looking
exciting.
Very hard on that in between wrangling my children and walking the dog. Yes, definitely.
And the great thing is it's going to be an on-demand course, so people can do it at any time. And if you're like me and you kind of surf the internet at 2 a.m. and you find interesting things like that, you can download it and do it at 2 a.m. if you want to.
Exactly. And it's going to be really, really good, because if there's one thing that I try to do in all of my courses, workshops and everything else, it's I try to make it useful. So it's going to have a lot of interesting, useful information. And the first question that people ask me is, when do I start? And I'm going to say to you, you start now.
Yeah, so, as in start building your platform.
Start
now.
Building your platform. Yeah. Yes, as soon as
and
possible.
And our stuff is very practical, because the thing is you get a lot of stuff out there where they say, well, here are your options, but they don't give you any guidance as to which option to take. Mm-hmm. And I know that yours is I've done workshops with you. It's very, very how-to, very, very step-by-step. So, yes. And it's very much laid out. But if you're interested in, now it hasn't launched yet, but if you're interested in registering your interest, because you will get a super duper bonus if you do for when it does launch, and trust me, it will be worth it. Just go to writercentre.com.au/platform and we'll make sure that you get the secret squirrel bonus that's only available to people who register their interest.
I might register interest. I'd like the bonus. Sounds good to me.
So before we wrap up, what are you doing in this coming week before we chat?
I am just, you know, surviving and looking forward to, I'm going to treat myself to a massive breakfast by myself on the first day of school. So I'm focusing. I've got eyes on the prize and I'm just getting myself through. And of course I'll be having lots of fun with my boys in the meantime, but just today,
Patience gone.
Okay. I feel much better now, though, I have to say. You see, it's nothing like a good chat about writing just to really bring you back down from your moment of horror. Yes. And what about you? What are you doing?
I'm a bit preoccupied at the moment because of the $2,500 MRI bill.
Oh.
And also, more importantly, preoccupied at my little baby Rex. And I can't wait to hopefully get
it all
clear.
I believe there's that much going on under all that beautiful fur.
I know. Yes, he's a complex character.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Oh, yes, deep.
Let's hope the pet insurance kicks in. But anyway, thank you everyone for listening. And if you do have 30 seconds to leave us a review or a rating on iTunes, that would be really great.
Yes.
It really helps us with the ratings. Obviously, feel free to connect with us and have a chat with us on social media. Alison, where do we find you?
You'll find me on Twitter at Al Tait, A-L-T-A-I-T. You'll find me on Facebook at Alison Tait Writer. And you will find me, at alisontait.com.
Of course, yes.
Of course.
And you'll find me at valeriekoo.com, but you can connect with me on social media at valeriekoo on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook as well. So until next week, we look forward to chatting to you then.
We do.